Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As you know, we tape our show via Zoom on Sunday so that you can hear it on Monday, but this is, of course, Memorial Day weekend, so it may sort of change a little bit of the conversation that we have today. But before we begin our Rethink the Week, we begin with Lieutenant Colonel Vindman in his testimony during the impeachment hearing of 2019. Here he is, his powerful testimony, where he assures his papa it will be okay. And of course, we know it was not okay for him or his twin brother.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
It is our Rethink the Week. I have to thank my two guests because I have to tell you, I must have contacted like 35,000 people. I mean, nobody wanted to do politics. They wanted a time off. Dean Spiliotis' daughter is graduating with a virtual graduation. So I was like, oh my God. But
wait a minute. Yeah. You're saying we were 35,001 on the list? Is that what you're telling us?
No, that's not true. Val, you actually booked before. So Val Endres is a professor of political communication at Rhode Island College. She is a regular on Rethink the Week. Stephen Pepere is a CARSI fellow and teaches at UNH Manchester and is an expert on issues of poverty and all the things that we actually are focusing on now because the pandemic is exposing everything that is now your area of expertise. And I'm so glad you're here. But you two said yes immediately. And then Dean said his daughter was graduating. I said, no big deal. I can find a third. What was I thinking? So thank you for joining us because this is kind of our work. But because it is Memorial Day weekend, I decided that I wanted to do something that recognized that. I have a friend, Marilyn Nelson. Marilyn Nelson was the poet laureate of the state of Connecticut. She taught at the University of Connecticut at Storrs. I have known since I was 17. And in 2019, she received the Poetry Foundation's Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize, the annual award for outstanding lifetime achievement. It is one of the most prestigious awards given to American poets. But why am I going to read a poem by Marilyn on Memorial Day? Her father was a Tuskegee Airman, and she writes a lot about her experience with her father in the Air Force and also his experience. The title of the poem that I'm going to read is Lonely Eagles. It is for Daniel Chappie James, General, U.S. Air Force, and for the 332nd Fighter Group. Being Black in America was the original catch, so no one was surprised by 22. The segregated airstrips, separate camps, they did the jobs they'd been trained to do. Black ground crews kept them in the air. Black flight surgeons kept them alive. The whole group removed their headgear when another pilot died. They were known by their names, Ace and Lucky, Skyhawk Johnny, Mr. Death, and by their positions in planes, red leader to yellow wingman, do you copy? If you could find a fresh egg, you bought it and hid it in your dope kit or your boot until you could eat it alone. On the night before a mission, you gave a buddy your hiding places as solemnly as a man dictating his will. There's a chocolate bar in my Bible. My whiskey bottle is under my bedroll. In beat up Flying Tigers, they had seen action in Burma. They shot down three German jets. They were the only outfit in the American Air Corps to sink a destroyer with fighter planes. Fighter planes with names like By Request. Sometimes the radios didn't even work. They call themselves Hell from Heaven, the Spukwaffe, my father's old friends. It was always maximum effort. A whole squadron of brother men raced across the tarmac and mounted their planes. My tent mate was a guy named Starks. The funny thing about me and Starks was that my air mattress leaked, and Starks didn't. Every time he went up, I gave my mattress to Starks and put his on my cot. One day, we were strafing a train. Strafing's bad news. You have to fly so low and slow. You're a pretty clear target. My other wingman and I exhausted our ammunition and got out. I recognized Starks by his red tail and his rudder's trim tabs. He couldn't pull up his nose. He dived into the train and bought the farm. I found his chocolate, 3 eggs, and a full fifth of his hoarded up whiskey. I used his mattress for the rest of my tour. It still bothers me sometimes. I was sleeping on his breath. Marilyn Nelson. In the most amazing way, she conveys such a powerful, powerful story. Such a powerful story, everyone. I don't mean to cry, but how do you not? And I just thought I would just share really quickly, since it is Memorial Day. I had two uncles I never met. One uncle died in the South Pacific on a PT boat, and the other uncle was rushing home to help and hold the hand of his grieving mother. He too was in the Navy, but he caught a flight that was going to New York, and it was an Air Force flight. And he got on the plane, and that was the plane that flew into the Empire State Building. So in his attempt to come home to comfort his mother, he too died. So the only thing I remember was that my grandmother never talked about my uncles, but the two most precious things in my family were two triangular flags, one for each of them. So I thought I would give both of you a chance, if you wanted to tell a story, but I had Marilyn tell the story of her dad with Tuskegee Airmen, and that's my story since I never met them, but I have their triangular flags. Val, anything you want to say?
I just want to say that when we're commemorating those who were lost, and especially in war, I think one of the things that we can also think about are those who lived but came back damaged. And the one thing that I remember so starkly is that my father was in Patton's Army during World War II, and I found out much later after he died, he had actually worked to help liberate some of the concentration camps. But I read some of his letters, and they were like travelogues, and as if he were vacationing in France or in Germany. And so I think that we've had many generations of soldiers who have suffered silently but valiantly, fought for our country, and that silence, I think, also needs to be honored as well.
My husband was served in Vietnam. He never talked about it. Mm-hmm. When did I learn about my husband's experience in Vietnam? You'll love this, Stephen. He died, and one of his closest friends who served with him wrote a 4-page letter that he could not read and share with us, but he wanted someone to read at his funeral. That's when I learned about Marty's experience in Vietnam. I had to learn it from a friend who wrote a letter because he had died, because Marty would never talk about it. Mm-hmm. Stephen, anything you want to share?
So I always have these deeply ambivalent feelings around Memorial Day, because on the one hand, want to recognize the men and women who have been killed in at least putative service to their country, but also to sort of feel the frustration and the anger about the national failures that have led so many of them to be put in harm's way in the first place, right? So it's not just the tragedy of their loss, but is this sense of needless loss in so many instances, right? I think we might carve out lots of World War II as the exception that proves the rule here, right? But when you think of more recent American foreign adventures, it's this sort of layers upon sadness because we've sort of got to recognize that this did not need to be, right? This did not need to happen. And it's the other thing that I think about a lot, because I spent so much of my professional career working with homeless people in New York City, is the disproportionate share of people who are homeless and have undiagnosed and untreated mental illness, who experience those conditions precisely because they suffered the trauma of war, and the nation that sent them off there did not then commit to caring for them upon their return.
Exactly. Ken?
Yeah, that's really a great point, Stephen. And I think it's important to remember both parts of that equation. The individuals who fought and died and bravely went into war, they deserve a lot of credit and honor. I remember when I turned 18 being scared to death, being drafted and going to Vietnam, and certainly not something that anyone welcomed, to be at risk that way. It's interesting how honor and patriotism work. My father got out of dental school just before America got into World War II, and he volunteered to go in and serve as a dentist in the war. He served in St. Petersburg, Florida, where my mother had gone to high school and where they had gotten married. We would, as a family, would go down there every year, and my father would proudly point out this hotel where your father won the war. He would say, "Look at that, boys, that's the hotel where your father won the war." And I would think, that's pretty lame, you know, this guy has the privilege of not being subjected to fire and, you know, doing dental work. But the idea that everybody is contributing, and obviously if the troops went overseas with toothaches and were in excruciating pain, they would be a lot less effective. But the power of all being in it together, you know, Trump has made our country so much not in it together now that the contrast with the World War II mentality is just so stark.
Well, I'm going to bring it into Trump now, because I'm going to not talk about his golfing. I'm going to talk about a story that was at Slate.com from maybe about 2 or 3 days ago. Here's the title: Trump administration to end National Guard COVID deployments one day before GI Bill benefits kick in. Oh my God, I saw this story and I posted it on Facebook and I wrote, "This story makes me want to vomit." That's how I posted it. Trump is a complete and total bastard. Share with every National Guardsman you know and their families. Here's the nugget. In 2017, Donald Trump signed something called the Forever GI Bill at his company's golf course in Bedminster, New Jersey. Oh, how convenient. The law expanded the educational benefits that had been made available under the post 9/11 GI Bill, which was passed in 2008, and which was supplemental to various other benefits that went back to the original GI Bill in 1944. The White House would later tout the Forever GI Bill as an example of how Trump was working tirelessly to provide the benefits and services that our veterans deserve, close quote. In late March, the Trump administration authorized the deployment of members of the National Guard to help local authorities conduct coronavirus tests, set up field hospitals, and perform other critical public health tests that carried a risk of infection. More than 40,000 service members have been deployed in total. But Politico now reports that they will all be recalled on June 24th, one day before the first group sent into the field would have reached the 90-day active duty minimum that's required to qualify for GI Bill education benefits and for a retirement benefit that was also created in 2008. Says the news site, the official was a FEMA staffer who reported this. Oh, God, Val, one day before. Well, I'm sorry. This is a story that, I mean, his base loves him for whatever reason. How do his base thread this story with their admiration and love, and he can do no wrong with them? I mean, the chutzpah of one day before, it's just unthinkable. And I wanted that story out there on Memorial Day too, because this is how he memorializes them. He screws them. He uses them and then throws them away 24 hours before they would qualify. It is just shocking.
Well, my first comment would be that probably his base isn't watching or reading Slate magazine, and they're listening to watch to Fox News, where they're not reporting on this. But this has long been a travesty of the Trump administration, that he talks about improving VA hospitals, but he hasn't actually supported with extra money. He's talked about mental health and our veterans and never actually has supported it with money. And as Stephen was talking about with our veterans, this exacerbates poverty. And now he's taking away education benefits and retirement benefits. But, you know, he is nickel and diming America in order to pay for the corporate subsidies. And it's got to come from somewhere. And so we're seeing this across all kinds of domestic programs and also in the military. They're not immune to it. But yet, if you look at the whole notion of re-entering the arms war, which you had a great article about, and you talk about the kind of waste in military weaponry, and there's where we need the inspector generals to bring that budget under control. The budget is virtually limitless, but when it comes to supporting people, and the Trump administration turns its back every chance it gets in a whole host of venues.
Well, this story, Stephen, has actually finally gotten some traction. I'm now seeing it on MSNBC. I'm seeing it on CNN. People are finally picked it up. But to me, and what was so ironic was, Ken, this week we were talking to a woman who was talking about the food delivery system, and how there was so much dumping, you know, dumping of milk, dumping of potatoes. And here we have people hungry, hungry. We have food banks that are starving for food because there's miles long of cars waiting. Mm-hmm. People who have never gone to a food bank in their entire life are suddenly doing it. And I said to her, well, I know what we can do. We can use the National Guard, is what I said, because they're good at delivery. That's what they do. You know, I said, why aren't they using them to bring the pork, the chicken, the milk, the potatoes? I said this the next day. This story comes out the next day, because I was like, well, now we know why they're not going to use the National Guard. Because if they use the National Guard to deliver food, it will be for more than 90 days, Stephen, because people are going to be hungry for a long time, because we're going to be in double-digit unemployment for a long time, and the unemployment benefits that they're getting now are going to disappear August 1.
You know, so I've got no inside knowledge as to what the rationale in the Trump administration is behind this kind of activity. There are a couple of things that come to mind, knowing what we know about the ways in which it's engaged in the past. And to be honest, part of me wonders if particularly the hitting the one-day deadline mark is not simply a crude expression of power and authority, is a way to say, F you, I can do whatever I want and I can get away with it. Watch this, right? I mean, that strikes me as entirely plausible given the ways in which the administration operates in a number of different ways. The other thing that comes immediately to my mind is to think about, you know, we no longer live in a world in which there is a draft. We have all volunteer armed forces, although we are currently engaged in the longest war in all of American history in Afghanistan. And if you look at the composition of those armed forces, who are they? They are disproportionately lower income men and women of color who enroll in the armed forces, often specifically in order to access educational benefits, right? Exactly. It strikes me as entirely plausible that is part of the administration's willingness to demonstrate their contempt for those individuals.
Well, you know, this actually goes to something else that just happened today. So I want to remind everyone, we Zoom on Sunday. The New York Times today, its front page was little tiny obituaries of 1,000 of the 100,000 that have died from COVID-19. It is an incredibly powerful visual, an incredibly powerful. So I posted it on Facebook, but let me tell you what I said. What I said was, imagine what they would have to do if they were doing just one thousandth, because this is only 1,000 of the, was it 100th or whatever the number is, of the 100,000 that have died. I said, imagine how many they would have to do in November, just before the election, because how many will have died by then, all right? And I said, they will have to fill an entire New York Times magazine section, not to cover all of them, but just a tiny percentage of them. But Val, here's what I want the New York Times to do, and I hope they have the guts to do it. I want them to also do something. I want them to color code it. I want to know who is Black and Hispanic in those numbers, in those names, in those tiny obituaries. I want people to see that it's not just names, it's not just obituaries, but it's names of Black and Hispanic people who have suffered so much as a result of this, because guess what? They are lower income. They've never had access to adequate healthcare. They come with pre-existing conditions. They live in places where there's pollution. So they have obviously so many other underlying issues. I want them to color code it, because it is important for people to see not just the names, but the consequences, and for what part of this country, who has suffered the most. It, to me, is so important that names alone are not enough, given what we know about.
Well, and I also think that cutting off the benefits, like you talked about with the National Guard, but also cutting off unemployment benefits or not giving Americans a regular income is akin to genocide. Because one of the things that happens is that these essential workers are out there. I'm very privileged. I get to work from home. I teach from home. But the people who are out there have a tendency to be, you know, are the essential workers are people of color. Yeah. And so I was fantasizing about what could this look like? And how could we make it fair for essential workers? And I was hearkening back to, maybe it's because of its Memorial Day, the World War II generation, and each one of us accepting responsibility for the fact that it's our turn. And you could have people who take their turn to deliver groceries for people, that learn how to use a cash register. So that we're, I mean, if you're talking about
I hear you.
It's not just a media, you know, myth that we're all in this together. We're not all in this together.
No.
And in the same way that people were planting victory gardens and women went to the factories in World War II, you know, what we should do if we're really serious about this racial disparity is that we need to level the playing field. Of course we need people out there working. You know, we need groceries. But this, a way to level the playing field is to have a call for government service.
So Stephen, one of the things that's interesting is people are complaining about the fact that the unemployment benefits now have been enhanced by $600 a week, which for a lot of people, especially the people that immediately became unemployed, is a significant amount of money. In some cases, it's more than they were ever earning. Okay. And what bothers me is that the people who are the essential workers are still earning their crap salaries.
Yes.
Okay. And they might have gotten a dollar more, maybe $2 more, but the $2 doesn't even come close to the 600. I mean, $2 times 40 hours a week is $80. Okay. Not 600. I know what we should do starting August 1st. We should make sure that those essential workers get the additional 600.
That's right.
That's what they get. They don't just show up for work and take the risk of dying, whether it's at a pork plant or whether it's at a market basket or whatever it is, that they get that kind of compensation, and we collectively help pay for that. That is actually our responsibility too. It's not just the unemployed, it's the employed that are running risks of dying. Why? So we can be fed? So we can have a hamburger? I mean, let's be honest here. Or frankly, if we can go to church. I mean, now church, according to Donald Trump, is essential. And I'm thinking, really? When did Jesus use a building? Last time I checked, he was feeding people with fishes and loaves, and there wasn't a brick and mortar in sight. In fact, he cleansed temples. That's about as close as he ever got to a brick and mortar. You know, it's just, to me, it's amazing. But in a way, we need to start threading that. I don't want to resent the extra 600. I want to make sure that those people who are in nursing homes and people who are at grocery stores and people who are those essential workers who are, you know, doing our public transportation system, that they get that too.
I am not hopeful that we have that in our future. I mean, if you think back to, I was, insufficient though they are, I was actually quite surprised at the breadth of the emergency relief programs, the sort of the three bills that have emerged out of Congress, was pleasantly surprised because my expectations were pretty low. When I go back and look at the timing of those, it seems to me that part of the explanation for why Congress acted was not concern about the well-being of low-wage workers, but concern about a tanking stock market and an effort to send as many signals as they could to people with money in the market that the market would be safe and the economy would be protected. So they dumped as much money out as they could. I think, unfortunately, one of the worst things going against the idea of extended or expanded relief right now is the fact that the stock market has stabilized. I think the best shot to get Congress to act is for the market to tank again. I don't think there are any other signals that certainly the Senate majority or the White House is particularly concerned about, unfortunately.
Well, but I think more than even what the Congress did, it's the Fed. I mean, the Fed has been buying up junk bonds.
Well, the Fed has been, I think, doing literally everything it possibly can to inject liquidity into the system, including begging Congress to do the stuff that the Fed cannot do.
But you know what's so interesting to me? I mean, I know we have to go to a break, and that is, so Val, the Chinese are saying to the Americans, are you starting another Cold War with us? The Chinese control and hold so much of our damn debt. Why isn't Xi calling in the debt? Why isn't he doing, you know what? I mean, you're talking about Wall Street. I am just trying to figure out why he isn't playing, you know, if you're going to bust my chops, I'm going to bust your chops. You're blaming us for the Wuhan virus, which is what they're calling it. And Donald Trump is doing everything to suggest it. It is turning into brass knuckles between these two. But frankly, who actually has more power over us than us is China.
Yeah, I've been worried about that. And Trump seems to be doing everything he can to trigger that kind of response. Whether or not there's a downside on their side to doing something like that, I would assume that there is, but I'm not an economist. But I've been wondering about this constant provocation of China. Why is he so, his eyes are so trained on China on these issues and provoking them?
Well, we have to go to a break, but what's amazing to me is, so he makes love to Putin and he's like, you're trying to like do whatever, I don't know what he's doing with China. I mean, he's so inconsistent, that's his problem. But the irony is, Russia is a minor player on the economic stage, a minor player. In a bizarre way, I don't think Donald Trump really quite believes that. He still has this image of Russia from like the 1950s or whatever. And what he doesn't quite comprehend is that China, not only is it the most explosive economy, but has already sort of stepped into the vacuum that we have created all over the world. And they are now the essential country. We are no longer that. All right, we need to go to a break. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude, Rethink the Week. We'll be right back. Rethink the Week, of course, my producer, Ken Barnes, and our two guests, Val Endres is a political communications professor at Rhode Island College. Stephen Pimper is a fellow at the Carsey Institute, as well as a professor at UNH Manchester. Stephen, we got to talk about the inspector generals. Every time I turn around, there's another one that, you know, basically has bit the dust. And the one that nobody has been talking about is the inspector general at the Department of Transportation has also been let go. And I am thinking, DOT, who does transportation? Is that Mitch McConnell's wife that is the head of DOT? Is that who it is? I think it is. So I am going, oh my God, we've been all sort of looking off on the right or the left, and they've been even getting rid of more inspector generals, but they're less high profile. But in some ways, maybe they should be the most high profile because of who it is and who she's married to. I mean, what is Donald Trump doing? And the Democrats are like waxing poetic about who's Joe Biden going to pick for his VP. I'm thinking, talk about inspector generals. This really is a travesty.
Ordinary level corruption is a problem, but it is not the problem that we are currently facing, right? So the accusation that Pompeo was, right, using a staffer illegally to walk his dog, that is corrupt and that is illegal, but, you know, we got bigger dogs to hunt at this problem. Likewise with Elaine Chao. You know, I find myself regularly turning back to what we know about Steve Bannon, who you will remember no longer formally works for the White House, but we know continues to be in regular communication with the president and with at least senior members of the staff. And one of the core principles of Bannonism is that you undermine in any way possible, first the administrative state, in order to remove checks on executive power. And while you are doing that, you undermine the legitimacy of every other institution, both internal to the government and external to it, that could also serve as a check on the president, right? So we're talking about opposition parties, we're talking about the courts, we're talking about Congress, we're talking about the media, we're talking about universities, right? We're talking about any institution that could conceivably serve as a check on executive power. That is the context in which I think about the what now appears to be systematic effort to remove each and every inspector general from the federal government of the United States, which have theoretically, right, it turns out they don't, we're learning, right, independent authority and power to ensure that actors within the government are not corrupt. If they're gone, it's easier to do stuff.
Right, but they have independent power, Val, except who can remove them?
The president.
The one person who can remove them has no respect for independent power. No one should have power but him. I mean, what is so amazing is that every norm has been smashed by this president.
Yes.
And now we can no longer, going into the future, ever assume that a norm has meaning, that a norm matters, because Donald Trump has shown that he can destroy every norm. And what is so depressing to me is, how do we then put everything into law? How do we somehow write it so that kind of destructive behavior, that kind of undermining of every inspector general you could have possibly imagined, is being removed by him? Because he doesn't want accountability. He doesn't want oversight. He wants control. I saw an article at the Washington Post, and it really did strike me as so interesting, because Stefan Schmidt, I used to do a ton of radio with Stefan, who teaches at Iowa State. And what was so interesting, I learned so much about Senator Grassley. But one of the things I learned about Senator Grassley was that he was a big champion of the whistleblower. He wanted to protect the inspector generals. I understood that, and he is one of the most senior members in the entire United States Senate. And here's the Washington Post story. Trump's stiffest challenge to Grassley's self-appointed role as defender of inspector generals. It says the 665-word letter had gone, as expected, unanswered. So Senator Charles Grassley fired off an email to the White House counsel's office pressing for an explanation as to why President Trump abruptly dismissed an inspector general who played a key role in the Ukraine scandal that led to Trump's impeachment. Well, I don't know. That's a couple of inspector generals ago. He needs a Rolodex to keep on top of all the inspector generals that have been removed. But once again, what we've seen is that even the historic position of a Grassley has been completely castrated by this president. Because even if he ever cared, I'm not sure he has a Gatling gun to go after him all the time. And frankly, he won't. You know it.
I think you're right, Arnie, and this is a really frightening development, but I'm going to take a more optimistic view on it. And that is, you know, when I talk to my students about First Amendment rights, for example, one of the things that we know is that you have freedoms until you impinge upon somebody else's freedom, and then we have to make a law. So laws prevent the violation. And I would argue that having a law to keep the inspector generals in place is long overdue, and some senators are talking about that right now. Because inspector generals really have been the bane of a president's existence. This isn't the first president who's come up against an inspector general. It's meant not to have a warm and fuzzy relationship. And so I think the next logical step, I'm happy that this is happening, God willing, toward the end of the Trump administration. And I think Congress needs to pay attention to having some laws in place that stabilize that position. Right. Because they are vulnerable to presidents who want to take shortcuts, or they want to look the other way with overspending, or with some graft that's happening inside departments. And so they are meant to be adversarial, and for that reason, they should be protected.
Well, as soon as you know that the reason for their existence is to talk truth to power, you need to protect them from the power that can remove them. Stephen, and then
I agree. I mean, I absolutely completely agree in principle, Val. But the problem is that we enact that law now, and what we are locking into place is the hacks and lackeys that Trump has put in, who cannot be counted on to operate in the manner in which that position was intended to operate. So they will not serve as sort of responsible independent checks, but they will serve as partisan hatchet men.
Ken, you want to make a comment?
In my mind, the balance is really the ability of the inspectors general to be independent and to go and investigate without the president throwing them out because you happen to disagree with me. That's what the inspector generals are being fired for. There's no standard. Yes, Trump, the president, should have power to remove people in the executive branch, and some of them should be removed with no reason. But people in quasi-law enforcement kind of positions, like these watchdogs, the inspectors general, the president should have some kind of good reason to remove them, such as they're not doing their jobs, they're not being competent, or something like that, abusing their power, harassing the government in a not public interest kind of way. The president shouldn't be able to just fire them because every time.
But who's going to enforce that if the president is Trump?
He may do something.
But wait a second. Didn't Nancy Pelosi say, Val, that this might be illegal, his removal of the inspector generals?
No.
Because the people who, like Pompeo, who asked to have the inspector, remember, Pompeo went to Trump and said, remove this inspector general. And of course, the first story was it was because of the dry cleaning and because of the Chinese food and it was because of the driving. And then we find out, oh no, it has something to do with sale of ammunition to Saudi Arabia. And then we find out.
It's Iran-Contra all over again. It's illegal activity in Saudi Arabia, contravening an explicit law of Congress is what was really going on there.
And in addition to which, he's holding these very, very sumptuous meals at the Secretary of State's office that have nothing to do with Secretary of State, but appear to have to do with him either running for the United States Senate in Kansas or perhaps running for president in 2024. And we know about who's on this list. It has nothing to do with the State Department because my freaking governor, Chris Sununu, first of the nation primary in New Hampshire, is invited to one of these dinners. What does Chris Sununu have to do with the State Department? Niente. Why did Mrs. Pompeo insist that Chris Sununu come? Well, what is she doing with an office at the State Department? I mean, the whole thing is so sordid that I mean, if nothing else, here's the good news. I'm glad they fired the IG. I think it completely castrated Pompeo. He does not have a political future. He is not going to be running for the United States Senate, and sure as hell, he's not going to be running for president. And why? Because of the corruption of what he just did with his own IG.
But there always is this risk here, and I think the most undersold words in the Trump administration is rule of law. For example, Donald Trump is supposed to, in writing, show just cause, but he refuses to do so.
And there's supposed to be a 30-day hiatus before that individual can be removed and replaced.
That's right. That's right. And so he further castrates Congress by just thwarting the law by doing this. But also remember, and your article points this out very well, Barack Obama did the same thing in that he didn't give just cause for firing an inspector general. So again, I'm going back to the idea of when we see these problems in rule of law, you know, we have to institute some other laws in order to prevent some of these problems.
Look, Barack Obama next to Donald Trump is like night and day, except I'm going to go back to it because we're going to segue into Joe Biden right now. I'm going to remind you, Joe Biden's son, Hunter, was working for that Ukrainian oil and gas guy. And according to the ethics rules within the Obama administration, the fact that his father was tasked with dealing with corruption in Ukraine and his son was working for one of those people who was corrupt in Ukraine, that was okay according to the ethics rules. Well, first of all, I don't know what kind of ethics rules would make it okay. I don't know how you not look and say this is wrong. But again, under Barack, how narrow were those rules? You know, it's what he did with his own IG and fired him. So there isn't perfection there. What we are learning is we need to unfortunately have a much more expansive, you know, ethics rules for, you know, how to play by the rules within the administration.
But I don't think that's right. I don't think the problem is the rules. I think the problem right now is the lack of means to enforce them. If we go back to, right, think about sort of the debates around the crafting of the Constitution itself, right? It's Madison himself recognized that someone like Trump could be in office, right? Enlightened statesmen will not always be at the helm, he wrote, right? So the logic of it was that these other institutions defending their own turf, right, would serve as that check. So no individual as president would be able to act like a king because Congress wouldn't allow it. Of course, not anticipating that we would, A, develop political parties and that they would be hyper-partisan to the point where they defend the interests of the party over the interests of the institution. Absent changing that dynamic, write all the damn rules and laws you want. Nothing is going to change if you've got someone like Donald Trump in that office and Mitch McConnell as majority leader.
Oh, yeah. All right. So there is a chance that the Democrats could take over the Senate. There is that chance.
I wouldn't have said that 6 months ago.
There truly is a chance, which is kind of delightful. But more than that, Val, I'm listening to what Stephen just said. Let's say Joe Biden wins and the Democrats control now everything. They control the House. They control the Senate. Actually, Joe Biden's going to be an unhappy camper because unlike the Democrats under Barack Obama, there are a group of Democrats that will be a watchdog on the administration in a way that has never existed before. Yes, it's their president. Yes, it's their party. But you know what? All that corruption stuff, all that loosey-goosey stuff, all that replacing an IG without the 30 days, all that stuff, they are now prepared to put a check on their own president. That wasn't true before with Barack Obama. That will be true with at least a significant number of people in the House and a handful of people in the Senate. It is not going to be a walk in the park for Joe Biden. Let me tell you right now, the progressives are going to be the watchdog. The progressives are going to be the IGs, little IGs everywhere. And that's not a bad thing. You know, I think that really is a good thing because I want a government I can feel proud of. I want a government that's transparent. I want a government that's accountable. And just because you have power and you're my power doesn't mean you get a pass. And I think that is just so amazing about what is possible going into the future after the 2020 election.
And I don't know how unhappy Biden's actually going to be because he's never sufficiently answered the question for me why he wants to be president. And so whether he's going to be that ambitious Or I was quite surprised, for example, when he...
Well, you must not be a woman, Val. Oh, no, that was black. I'm sorry. Just to quote Joe Biden out of context here, but you know exactly...
But I'm wondering, you know, people are talking about his capacity for listening. For example, he started to listen to Elizabeth Warren about healthcare, and so he's loosening his reins on his plan for healthcare. And so does Joe Biden just want to be president and will get along with Congress, and he has a long history and in the Senate, and will he, I think he'll have the respect of the Senate like LBJ did, but he won't have the ambition that LBJ had.
No, but he'll be valuable. He'll be, no. See, there's a difference. LBJ was ferocious. He was ferocious. And he knew how to manipulate Congress. That was his gift. Joe doesn't know how to do that.
And I'm not sure what he actually wants to do. And out of all the presidential candidates, I'm not sure he can answer that question as to
but
why.
But I'm not sure it matters. And I mean, you know from my appearances on this program that I am no particular fan of Joe Biden. I think he has caused enormous harm to large segments of the country in terms of the policies that he's advocated historically. However, I will say this. Biden has always worked really hard to position himself squarely in the middle of the party. It's been one of his gifts as a politician. The middle of the party is radically more to the left than it was the last time that he was either vice president or senator. I expect him to continue to behave as the same person. So he will try to advance those centrist goals of the party. And it will be, if there is a Democratic majority leader in the Senate, it will then be up to the Senate and the House to craft the legislation that he will be boxed into a corner and have no choice but to sign.
Ken?
I agree with that. I think certainly the fact that the center of the party has shifted to the left is an important factor to consider when dealing with, especially with presidency of a Joe Biden type. But I think another aspect of his centeredness, center of the partiness, is that the desire to not change things a whole lot from what they already are. And from that point of view, the center of the party, in terms of inertia and finances, is Wall Street. It's the liberal corporatists, the liberals in Hollywood who run the studios or whatever it is, but it is not the people that really want to change the country a whole lot. And I see Biden as somebody who's very, very loath to rock any boats.
Okay, so here's the good news.
Over the course of his whole history.
The boat is sinking. It's called the pandemic. And everything you said was true in January. It is not true today. Because what we are now seeing, given this pandemic, is that it has exposed so much rot. It has exposed so much inequity. It has put us into such deficit and disrepair. We are nothing on the world stage. We are nothing with public health. We're not prepared for climate change. We're not prepared to feed people. We're not prepared to make people healthy. Everything you said is true in January. It ain't true today. The pandemic has changed the calculus. The pandemic has changed the enormity of the whole. It has exposed the rot. One of the things, Val, that I thought was absolutely amazing is when he had that, you know, Charlemagne the God or whatever his name is, had that conversation where he was basically sort of said, "Hey, man, you know, you must not be black if you don't think that I am the best, you know, candidate for you." He doesn't get that talking about the Voting Rights Act for 25 years is one almost every senator had voted for, number one. And number two, what has been exposed by this pandemic is so much more acute and such an incredible failure that even his reference was the January reference, not the May reference, because what we now know today is so much more extreme and is going to force him to move in a very different direction. And it's not going to be the corporate direction.
I'm not sure that's the case.
You're responding to my point. And I think I agree with you completely that the situation has changed and it is much more clear how very much more we need to do to move the country to a more progressive place. I just am questioning whether Joe Biden is up to the task. I mean, look, that Charlemagne comment was just this week. Has he showed himself capable of making the move to the left? Go ahead, Val. I'm sorry.
Well, I think that he will have to do the repair of both the Trump administration and the pandemic. And that by itself could be defined as radical change to bring us back. Yeah. But I do not believe, and this is where I'm sort of agreeing with you, Ken, that he wants to move beyond the Obama presidency. I think he is very firmly rooted in the values of the Obama presidency and does not want to rock the boat. And his legacy is an extension of Obama. It's not moving forward.
Okay, but wait a minute,
Val. In order to get us back, he does have to do an awful lot. And one could argue that any president has his hands full just on repair. Not moving forward, but just on repair.
So, Stephen, I'm going to say something. Barack Obama would be the most leftist candidate today compared to the candidate he was in 2008. So here's the good news. What created Joe Biden was not Joe Biden. It was Clyburn and Obama, okay? Obama knows now that the kind, I mean, it's, you know what I see is my template.
Well, how do you know that, Arnie? I'll use this.
Gay marriage. All those lefties who said, oh, no, I believe in the institution of marriage, yada, yada. Now, and then all of a sudden, they all, like, embraced the idea of gay marriage. Like, it was okay. Oh, we've always got, I mean, I watched them. Once the switch happened, they were willing to sort of dive in and embrace it. Well, I'm telling you right now, Joe Biden has already sort of implied it by saying that healthcare is a right, be still my heart. And I actually believe that Barack Obama is now going to be the liberal that I thought he was and turned out not to be when he got elected, maybe in part because he was the first African-American president. Maybe, no, I'm telling you right now, I think
that— Oh my God, I think that's delusional. I think you are pinning your hopes on Barack Obama finally becoming the man you always thought he was, but never was in reality. Then we are all doomed, Arnie. We are just doomed. No. Come back to land with us, Arnie. Come back to land.
Stephen, one of the great disappointments about Barack Obama is that, yes, he was the first African-American president who did nothing for the African-American community. Nothing. Why? Because he was afraid. I believe he was afraid.
But that wasn't the greatest failure of the Obama administration. The greatest failure of the Obama administration, I would argue, is not prosecuting the Bush administration for the Iraq War and not putting some damn Wall Street bankers in jail. I feel, and there's some political science to back this up, right? That if he had actually prosecuted Wall Street and seized that opportunity, right? If he had taken that moment to be FDR in the wake of Hoover after the 2008 collapse, I don't think we get Trump, right? I think Trump is a consequence of Obama's failures because it took Obama until his second term to recognize that his fantasy of the bipartisan world in which we could all come together and work out deals was a world that no longer existed, if it ever did.
Well, look, let me tell you, the first time I was incredibly disappointed in Barack Obama, and it made me look through this lens going, oh my freaking God, what's he going to do in the 8 years, is when he approached Judd Gregg to join his administration. When he did that, I was like, you had to put me on the couch. I was like, what the hell are you doing? I mean, it was incredible to me. And I mean, right there, I'm thinking, this is not about bipartisan. You are selling out. If you think that appointment would make any sense in anyone's world. So, you know, I don't disagree, but I honest to God think, all right, I am naive. I am incredibly, incredibly hopeful because I actually believe that people can change. I actually believe that people can have a come to Jesus moment. I actually believe that people can see that what is needed is aggressive action on healthcare, not the frickin' Affordable Care Act. That what they can see is not some sort of tepid response to climate change, but some radical response because he has daughters too. He has daughters too. And I'm sorry, but I think that the man that ran for president is not the same man that is today. And the man that is today, because he will have such incredible influence over Joe Biden. This is Obama's third term. Let's be honest, boys and girls. This is Obama's third term. What will Obama be like in his third term? I don't think it will be middle of the road. I don't think it will be holding the hands of a Jamie Dimon and flashing POTUS cufflinks to people in the United States Senate. It will be very, very interesting. I really believe that people can change. And maybe, Val, I'm naive, but I served in the legislature and I watched people change. People who I never expected to change. I just think that because of his intellect, because of what's happening with the pandemic, because of climate change, because of what's happening with China, I believe that Barack Obama could be a different man today.
I'm not sure that I share your optimism there, but I do think you're probably right about Obama serving as a shadow counselor.
Yes.
And I also think, and I hate to circle around to this issue, but I think it also depends upon the strength of his vice president, because I get a real sense that Joe Biden wants to listen to somebody. And I'm not sure who he wants to listen to.
Other than his wife.
But he's sort of like the fellow who's looking for guidance. And that's what I mean by the fact that I'm not sure that I know why he wants to be president. And so if you look at it that way, he really is looking. And so his cabinet choices will be all the more important.
Well, but Stephen, one of the things that we're hearing now is that because of what happened with Charlemagne the God, it must be a black female VP. And so because now it's the only mea culpa that's going to work, as if somehow that's the solution. But as I say that, I go back to the Washington Monthly, which just has a story out, I believe this week, that the only person who could completely sort of make Joe Biden whole is who as VP? Michelle Obama. I mean, talk about an Obama third term. It'll never happen. I get it.
Yeah, and the idea that the way Joe Biden cleans up the mess that he has made for himself is to nominate a black woman is as insulting as the initial comment itself, right? As if black voters are just that dumb that they cannot see through that. The other thing is, I think it's useful to remind ourselves that every bit of research that emerges from political science tells us that we just don't have evidence that the VP selection matters.
It doesn't matter.
Pay a lot of attention.
Absolutely.
It'll matter in terms of governance. Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
Right, but let me, in terms of governance, Val, Joe Biden is an old man in every way. He's not only an old man in age, he's an old man in that he's dated. I'm old, but I'm hoping I'm less dated. He's old and dated. Mm-hmm. And that's his problem. He has been in this sort of interesting Delaware cocoon. And I use the word Delaware on purpose because, you know, remember from corporate law, Ken, where did you want to incorporate? Delaware. Why? Because it was such a loosey-goosey place to incorporate. It was like sort of nirvana for corporations.
Isn't that why you want to have a progressive woman as vice president, not necessarily a black woman? A progressive woman whose policies are young and future oriented to make the country better in the future.
Well, and let's be honest,
not necessarily someone who's black, but just as stodgy as Biden.
Talk to women of color about affirmative action. I remember being at a meeting at Simmons College, and I was sitting at a table that was 50-50, 50 white, 50 black. And the women were all executives, okay? But a lot of them had benefited from affirmative action, and they hated it. Why? Because the assumption was they got the job not because of the quality of their resume, not because of their management skills, but because of affirmative action. And they hated it because they said it undermined their credibility. It undermined their ability to manage. And I'm being told we have to end this. This is Rethink the Week, The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. I want to thank Val Endres. I want to thank Stephen Pimper. And of course, my producer, Ken Barnes. We'll chat tomorrow, everyone.